With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome back to Stream Close Up. I'm your host, Brian Laffin, here with my producer, Jose Fernandez Alameda, and our guest today is Eric Hueldeberg. Eric is a writer and director of film and TV who's worked in Hollywood, and his most recent project is the Norwegian TV phenomenon Occupied, where he is credited as co-creator. Among other things, he brought you the film Insomnia not once but twice. The original version in 1997 starring Stellan Skarsgård was remade later by the great Christopher Nolan and featuring Al Pacino, Hilary Swank, and Robin Williams in key roles, among others. We'll talk about that experience, a number of other projects that Eric has been responsible for, and dive in on Occupied. You may or may not remember the stir that it caused when it was first released two and a half years ago. It touched such a nerve that the Russian government felt compelled to make a press release through the embassy in Oslo, where they said, although the creators of the TV series were at pains to stress that the plot is fictitious and allegedly has nothing to do with reality, the film shows quite specific countries, and Russia, unfortunately, was given the role of an aggressor. It is certainly regretful that in the year when the 70th anniversary of the victory of the Second World War is celebrated, that the series creators decided to scare Norwegian viewers with non-existing threats from the East in the worst Cold War traditions. We'll ask Eric if that was his intention, to scare Norwegian viewers. I don't quite think so. I think they were out to entertain and provoke some thoughts. We'll find out. In for his stream close-up, Eric Hueldeberg. Eric Hueldeberg, welcome to Stream Close Up. Joining us today to talk about the phenomenon that is Occupirat in its second season, currently on Viaplay. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Eric is joining us remotely. We're going Stockholm to Oslo, Oslo to Stockholm. This is a new experience for the pod. I don't know if you've done this before, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays out for us. You have, in fact. Okay, good. Maybe you can guide me a little bit here. Eric is credited as the creator, writer, and director of the phenomenon that is Occupirat. I want to talk about that. We're into season two right now. I also want to get a little bit into your background. But before we go any further, can you tell people what it means to be a creator on a project like this?
It's similar to what the Americans call a showrunner. It means that I've been involved in nearly every creative decision regarding the show. So it means that I'm involved from the very beginning when we sort of create the story and characters up until the end when you do the sound mix and gone through all the editing and everything.
And how does the project come to life? It's based on a book by Joe Nesbø. Are you scanning material, looking for things to adapt all the time, or does it match up with something that you have in mind to begin with?
Now, this one is, it's actually a common misunderstanding that it's a book of Jo Nesbø, but it's not. It's you had an idea several years ago. This we're talking 2007. He had this idea about what if Russia came and there was a silk occupation of Norway, how would we react? I was contacted later on. Actually, first time I read about it was in the papers, and I thought, oh, that's...
So hang on, how does he express this idea? Is he sketching a screenplay, or is he outlining a book, or is he just talking about it?
He is... he's pitched this idea to Yellowbird Sweden, whom he's got a relationship through a film, and I guess maybe other things as well, but there's this film called Headhunter, which is based on a book, which was produced by Yellowbird and Marianne Gray, at producer at Yellowbird. So he's pitched it to Yellowbird, and they were really intrigued by this idea. They had worked on it for a while before I was contacted. I was occupied with doing several features at the time, and I read about it in the paper, and I thought, this is an original idea. I get pitched several ideas quite often, but this one stood out for me, even reading about it in the paper. And I thought, oh, that must be something to be working on. Then I probably didn't think too much about it because I was too involved in a feature, but the producers got in touch while I was working. And I immediately said, yeah, I'd be interested to talk to you and to sort of look into this idea. And then I think it was a coincidence, but at the time when I got involved, the project was sort of moved from the state channel NRK here in Norway. They moved out of the project for reasons I'm not sure of. So the whole project was rebooted. And at that point, I got involved with a group of writers. And he had this basic idea that what would you do? And I think he was particularly interested in the majority of people who don't take two arms if their country becomes occupied.
Either frozen by fear or just not knowing what they can do to influence things, or
I think there's,
for many different reasons?
I think there's several aspects. Statistically, if you look at any occupation, 90% of the people would not take to arms. These are the people who generally are not depicted in movies, because we are fixated on this hero image of people.
Where's the action?
Yeah. So, but he was interested in the other 90%, and so was I. So that was our common ground, and we were sort of thinking. I think there are several reasons why you wouldn't take to arms. I think it plays with, you don't know, it's an uncertain situation, you don't know the outcome, and you try to protect your closest values, which is normally your family, your job, income, and just sort of some kind of view of the future and how to survive.
You guys address this in so many different like levels in the story. You have the the political party lines. You have the military. You have the sort of family business people, the media, the police. Everyone with these competing balancing interests, trying to figure out where their place is in this, and making decisions independent of each other, but they'll impact each other. It's a really interesting mesh of storylines and the decisions that people have to make about how they're going to engage, whether they're going to fight or capitulate. Mm-hmm. Before we go deeper into Akipirat, you said the producers reached out to you. There's obviously a reason they reached out for you. You have quite a track record as a writer and director in feature films before you moved over to work with Akipirat and other TV projects. Can we talk a little bit about some of those?
Yes, please.
I mean, I guess your breakthrough was Insomnia in 1977 with Stellan Skarsgård in the leading role there.
Mm-hmm.
And can you tell us a little bit about how that project came together? Because I think it's interesting that it's had sort of two lives.
Mm-hmm. I attended film school in England. There was no film school in Norway at the time. This was early 90s. And I met a guy who didn't attend my school, but attended a different film school in London. He was a screenwriter. He was called Nikolai Frobenius. He was a fellow Norwegian. And we used to hang out. And he told me he had this idea and there might be someone in Norway interested in developing it. And so we got together and we sort of worked on this story for, I guess, for years, which is
the evolution of insomnia is from your days in film school.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
And I spent film school looking at classic movies more than sort of attending the sort of, it was a film school which didn't have so much of a curriculum in a traditional sense, at least that's how I remember it. But I sort of spent time sort of thinking about what kind of preferences I liked and didn't like. And I was drawn to thrillers and character-driven thrillers, you know, and so much of that influence, you know, it came into Insomnia as we developed it. We spent probably 3 or 4 years, the last 2 years of my film school and the first year after I finished. But compared to most film students, I was lucky because within 2 years we were in production.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a quick transition actually from graduating to getting something on the screen.
Yeah, I felt privileged because someone trusted me enough to do that. And then the casting process and how Stellan got involved, I couldn't find the right cast here in Norway. And then there was a colleague of mine, a senior colleague, who was sort of helping me out, who said he'd worked with Stellan once. And I think I was just, again, lucky because there was a project which Stellan had at the time which fell through. So he was available. My big job was to sort of convince him this was a good idea, you know. So I flew to Stockholm. We had several conversations, the idea must have grown on him, or maybe I was just for some reason I can't really explain able to convince him. But that was probably the best thing which happened to in the whole process, because he was a very, very constructive, demanding lead actor who and our collaboration on that project was very important to the result.
Probably very nice to have that input as a debut filmmaker, maybe a little less so these days on the set.
At the time it happened, I just thought, well, this is, I had this kind of youthful arrogance, you know, I thought this is what it's supposed to be like. But looking back on it, I think I was really lucky with working with Stellan for my first film. I realized that, yes.
And Insomnia was well received. It was commercially viable. It was well received by the critics. Mm-hmm. And it ends up getting a remake in the hands of Christopher Nolan, of all people. How does that come to pass? Did he discover the film? Were you guys out selling your script? Was someone peddling this?
No, I think Insomnia went to Cannes, not in the main competition, but one of the side competitions. Someone, a critic in Variety, had a sort of preview of it before, and he probably took pride in sort of discovering this film. So he wrote a sort of an extremely sort of positive review, which threw me into a world I had no idea of, you know, of the world of agents and, you know, of Hollywood taking an interest, you know. And
can I ask, how quickly does that unfold? Is that likely on site there that week, people start reaching out to you, or does it sort of slowly happen after the festival itself?
A bit of both, actually. There are people calling me that day, you know, people flying in from LA that day, you know, insisting on meeting me. I'm sort of from the countryside. I tend to get a little bit overwhelmed. I remember I did, you know. So I didn't jump on any first opportunities. I was more sort of thinking, well, what is this? But But one of the side effects was that the remake was sold, not to Warner Brothers in the first place, but to Steven Soderbergh's company. He had a company. I'm not sure if he's still running that same company, but they bought the rights. Now, it doesn't necessarily. There's a lot of remake rights which get sold. There's only
nothing happens.
Yeah, often it doesn't happen, you know. And I don't think they had a clear idea in the first place exactly what they wanted to do with it. I was approached as well in the early. Would I be interested? And I said no. I don't want to do the same film twice. I don't want to start out doing the same film twice. And then I went to the States and did another film. And then I heard of Christopher Nolan, who was a young filmmaker at the time, had seen his two first films. I thought they were great.
Is that around the time of Memento?
Yeah,
or?
Exactly. Okay. Just after Memento. And I heard he had an interest, and I thought that was a good idea. That sounded good to me. But I still held back a bit. I thought, well, normally remakes don't necessarily come off, you know, more often than not. And then Christopher Nolan, he was very polite. He would sort of mail, or through his producer, he would mail and sort of invite me to the set. I never grabbed that opportunity, but they also showed me the film as soon as before it was released. And
so you were sort of felt included, at least in the process somehow, or
yeah,
invited.
They were sort of, they kept me involved in to on some, at least they were polite enough to do, you know, the and it was strange to see a remake because it was kind of similar, but obviously it had a lot more resources thrown at it. They'd done some changes to the script, some which clarifies the plot in the early parts. Some in the later parts I felt I liked my original better. But all in all, I thought it was a good outcome because I still felt it was a good remake.
I think there's some interesting casting there, particularly Robin Williams sort of playing the evil role. I like when he goes down that dark path.
Yeah.
But it must be an odd sensation sort of to have done the blueprint and then sort of turn it over and let someone else come back with their vision of it. I guess there was some comfort that it was someone of the character of Christopher Nolan, who's a writer himself.
Mm-hmm. I think he had the clarity to see the story and see how it should work, you know. So he has that storyteller instinct, you know. Obviously, there's a screenwriter who's adapted it, you know, but I trust that he was involved, and the production company with Steven Soderbergh was involved too. So it made it, I think that's part of why it became successful.
Interesting. So you, on the back of the success of your version of Insomnia, you end up starting to work in the States. You kind of referenced your next film,
yes,
Prozac Nation.
Mm-hmm.
Are you relocating to Hollywood at this point, or how does this go?
No, I'm staying in a hotel for way too long. I never bought into the... I didn't start making films because I wanted to go to Hollywood. So I was kind of... on the other hand, I looked for opportunities, and they have the resources and all. I was looking to develop my own project in Hollywood, and it proved more difficult than I had thought when Insomnia first was successful, because it proved cast dependent, this project I was working
who's
with.
Who's attached to this project?
Yeah, who's attached? Who's the star? Maybe because it wasn't immediately commercial, the project I was working on at the time, but I got tired of chasing these stars, the same actors which everyone else is chasing. And at some point during that process, one of the production companies we're in conversation with, called Millennium, turns and or asks if I'd be interested in doing an adaptation of the book Prozac Nation with Christina Ricci playing the lead. And she was also attached as a producer.
Were you familiar with the book when they approached you, or was it a new concept for you?
It was new. I was familiar with Christina Ricci's work. I really, really liked her, some of her films and the way she performed in it. I checked around, and people who'd read the book said very complimentary things about it. So I got on the plane, which is a long flight, obviously, and read the book on the plane over, met Christina Ricci, met her twice, and then I didn't, and I had good meetings with her, but I was still aware, you know, there were several directors she was supposed to meet. I think on my plane, on my trip back, she must have made her decision or sort of or expressed her preferences, because when I got back, there was lots of phone calls, you know, going. And when Hollywood wants something, they can be very, very persuasive. There was very few catches, you know. They didn't really have a script, and they had a sort of pocket. They wanted to go into shooting in within 10 weeks or so, which to me felt in sort of Scandinavian model felt reckless. So we had lots of discussions, but I ended up saying yes. I think we got it pushed, but it was still sort of 16 weeks or so from the moment saying yes to sort of writing it and sort of on set.
From looking at the book the first time to getting things under production. Wow.
Yeah. So it was super quick.
It's an interesting dynamic that you describe there, though, where, you know, sometimes you're out chasing talent, and in this case, the talent now is looking for the director, in Prozac Nation's case. So was that a positive experience for you overall? I mean, I guess it wasn't the hugest film, but it's very well respected.
It was shooting the film, working with actors like Christina and Jessica Lange, who got on board, and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, Michelle Williams. You know, it was the opposite of what I experienced so far, because for some reason, I think probably to do with the subject matter, a lot of these stars which I had been chasing before were actually sort of begging to be part of this project. So it was more a question of be careful you don't overcast it than the other way around. I loved the process of shooting it and all. The frustrating part came later on, because I learned a lot of things on that project. It wasn't a traditional, it could never have been a traditional sort of story if you were to sort of be honest to the book, you know, and make an honest adaptation and stay loyal to the fans of the book and all that, which was part of my agenda. It's to do with depression, which also is not commercial in of itself, you know, to
difficult
to,
subject, yeah.
Yeah, but so in a way it felt like in post-production I ran into a very different world from what I was used to here in Scandinavia, where a lot of people had lots to say and we were testing it and we were trying it out in different ways, and it was hard to hold it together. And I think probably there was a problem with people who had invested in it wasn't quite sure what they had invested in. They had invested in a book which was a sort of bestseller, but exactly what a book was about, but they'd never read it, you know. So they invested in some stars and a best-selling book, never mind the subject matter. So it was a struggle, and at the time when it was released, and it even had problems being released, it wasn't well received by the critics either, who the same critics who loved Insomnia. So that sort of made for sort of a mixed experience all in all. But looking back on it, it's a film which is still running on various platforms and actually has meant quite a lot to some people who've experienced this thing of depression, which is, well, as common today as it was in 2000. So I'd say, but it's probably my least commercial film I went to Hollywood to do, which wasn't a great career move, for sure.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. And so, yeah, so you go to Hollywood, you say your least commercial film, then you decide to go back to Norway, or do you look at other Hollywood alternatives, or do you look at anywhere else in the world, or is it a decision?
I had a girlfriend here, so we went... I was a bit torn, of course, because staying in Hollywood, I would have... There's just this quicker turnaround, you know. If I was offered other projects, none which was extremely interesting to me. But if I'd stayed around, I would have been able to find them. But apart from sort of making films, I thought LA felt a bit like sort of living. You're in a time zone where none of your friends are awake when you're finished work. So it felt sort of...
I've been there. The phenomenon of watching football kickoffs at 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning is a little tough to get your head around.
Yeah, well, you have to get up even earlier if it's an early kickoff, yes. That's for sure. So the year I spent there, I didn't feel like... happy. I didn't feel like sort of a full life, but it probably would have come. But there was decisions which made me, which to do with girlfriend. Then I went back. I sort of worked on developed a few projects, but got kids, and then I just decided I'm going to spend 10 years in Scandinavia with my kids, because I don't want to be one of those sort of seamen type of fathers who sort of go away. If you direct something, especially if you're involved in the screenwriting and everything, you'll be away for minimum 6 months. And I didn't really want that kind of life. So I made it clear to sort of all agents and everyone, you know, I'm actually going to drop out and stay in Scandinavia and try and work on interesting stuff here. Now, the 10 years have gone now, so the kids are, you know, well, my youngest one is 10. So I've said to myself, well, maybe I'll consider it again, you know, but the whole industry has changed, so I'll just see if I'm going to go back to
it. It seems to be an interesting time. It seems to be a very interesting time to be a creator here in this Scandinavian Nordic territories these days, with all these new opportunities for distribution that are popping up. During that 10 years, so you said you had a couple of projects that you tried to develop. Was one of those Nokas?
Yes, that was, I think, my fourth feature film. It's based on the biggest robbery in Norway. And
how long was that in your mind? Is it as soon as the robbery hits the news you start taking notes, or how does that evolve?
No, I was involved in a very sort of personal drama at the time of the robbery, so I didn't pay much attention to it at the time. But 3 years later, a producer and a screenwriter approaches me. They have this ID. It's a very sort of simple ID of sort of tracking the robbery on the morning when it takes place.
It's very historically accurate, I take it, the whole thing.
Yes, it. I can't say whether that was part of the ID, but when I was pitched that project, I immediately got a clear vision of how that could be done. And we started approaching everyone who was involved in the robbery: police, you know, victim, you know, bank assistants, robbers, you know, anyone who'd be willing to speak to us. And then we started cross-referencing these conversations to try and figure out the truth. It must have, you know, it'd been through the court case, but people have their agenda in court cases, and the press had sort of created a mythology around this, around this robbery. Maybe because the robbers themselves were so inspired by Heat, the movie by Michael Mann.
I don't know if you're familiar with the Swedish actor Dragomir Mrsic. He's in Snabba Cash, among other things. Yeah, we had him up here recently, and you know, he's got that background. He's a bank robber, and it was sort of romanticized for a period here in Sweden, and he's got a story to tell. Maybe you want to hook up with him and do his story since you have this experience. But sorry to interrupt.
That is interesting. It was a great experience to do this film. I decided to do it with non-actors because there wasn't really a lead. There was more to do with just track this robbery and see how everything influenced, every decision influenced the other, and how mistakes can be fatal, you know, because there's always mistakes in these kind of things.
Otherwise, we wouldn't know about the story.
Yeah, well, probably. So that's the mechanism we were looking for, and I'm working with non-actors. It took a long time to cast them because I needed to. With non-actors, you gotta you what you see in audition and what is basically more or less what you're gonna get. So you have to be sure. But if you find the right people, they have this authenticity and they can inform me about how things would be done in a different way to what you would do. I just felt like it was a film. I didn't want to be standing with an actor, me and an actor, and trying to figure out how all the sort of details, because I wanted sort of an authenticity, and I wanted to just feel right down to the detail of how a robbery would take place.
Interesting, but there must be some trade-off, though, on set, not having that sort of professionalism that sort of just greases the wheels and keeps things moving smoothly. So were there challenges working with these non-professionals?
It was challenging when we went from improvisation, because I collected a group, which, like the police, were policemen or former policemen or police in their family. You know, they had police in their blood, basically. And it's hard to talk about the robbers because, you know, but I went into sort of criminal groups and gangs, you know, trying to cast, you know. I can't say that, you know, the cast of itself is criminal. So but some of them definitely had friends or knowledge about this, you know. So I had to find people who were sort of able to do it the way kids would do, you know, able to play and sort of lose themselves in the game of sort of an improvisation.
So they might not know their way around a set, but they know the story and they're in it. They're so that they can portray it for you in a different way.
They know their characters and they move like their characters, and they have knowledge of exactly what a policeman would do or a bank assistant. You know, the tricky part is when you give them lines, because it just immediately when I gave them line, it started feeling they lost their. The very quality I sort of picked, the reason I picked them. So I had to go through a long process to sort of learn them how to deal with lines. So obviously, yeah, we had challenges, but I'd say once we got to the shoot, it was like a dream. I didn't feel any of that kind of, it felt very smooth shooting it, for sure. But we spent a long time preparing it.
Interesting process.
Oh, it was a great process, actually. And I, you know, I was working more like an investigative journalist, and I got in touch with lots of people through that process, which learned me a lot of things. Yes.
And following on that, you took on another historic story, the story of the expansion of the Norwegian oil fields and the divers who led the way to enable all of that. What led you to make Pioneer?
It was, to me, it was, I grew up in the 70s in Norway. We were not a rich country. We were the outskirts of Europe. We weren't poor but we were still sort of a working class culture, you know, sort of. And then through the 80s and 90s, Norway became so rich. And I just felt like, oh, that changed everything. And I sort of felt like I had a tagline saying, what does it cost to become rich?
Ah, okay.
And you know, what really emphasized this is the North Sea divers who in order to prove that you could actually make use of these oil fields they'd found out in the North Sea in the 70s. They had to prove that they could lay the pipelines, you know, and they had to prove that divers could operate on depths which had not previously been done. This became so important for the nation that bureaucrats, politicians, even scientists and doctors, you know, were willing to sort of manipulate the truth about the risk of what you go through.
Almost experiment with human guinea pigs.
Yeah. And the North Sea drivers themselves, they were more like sort of adrenaline seekers, you know, they inspired by the astronauts 10 years earlier, you know, and stuff like that. They were willing to push the limits. They didn't think far ahead. But what they experienced when they went into these experiments is they started hallucinating. They started making mistakes they wouldn't have done before, and that whole story, which is truth, and actually the North Sea diver had been suing Norwegian states for years and years and years, without getting the compensation they craved for. So that was part of why. So we constructed a story based on several of these incidents. It doesn't have the same truthful sort of it's more of a fictional work, Pioneer is, than
less Lucas. Of a journalistic exploration.
Yeah, so it's a different project. Can I ask?
Yeah. There must be some particular challenges filming underwater. Are you a diver? Is this something that's interesting to you personally? Oh, or
no, I'm afraid of water. I was never
perfect project.
Yeah. But I had to. I always do these things, you know. I went out on a dive, you know. I went into these compression chambers, you know, where you sort of adjust your body to a different environment. So I went through all these things, and just to get a sense of what it feels both mentally and physically and everything. Shooting it was tricky because the only film I really admired of the underwater films was The Abyss, which
oh, that's beautiful, yeah. Those underwater scenes, yeah.
I think it's because it had such depth of sight. It was clear water, which is normally not what you get. And we had, of course, we don't have a budget anywhere near The Abyss, and so we did a lot of research, and we ended up on Iceland there's like this glacier and an underwater and water from the glacier which is sort of filtered by lava sand, and it comes into a crevice, and we shot it there because they would guarantee us clear water. And then we used some VFX to enlarge the image some places. But I've had those, we got a lot of attention also from the States about how did we manage to make Pioneer for that kind of budget and those underwater sequences. So, you know, we did something right in that respect.
Congratulations. And I guess this starts to get you into the issue of oil and politics, which you'll revisit a little bit later in Akipirat.
Yeah, it's oil, well, petroleum, you know, gas, oil is so ingrained in Norwegian culture by now that, you know, any work, even, you know, if in the cultural field like I am, you know, if you think about it, you know that most of the money, which the state-funded part of film industry in Norway stems from our oil, because it's because the state actually sort of takes most of the money, you know, and then they distribute it in various ways. So it just felt. Relevant in many ways, you know, to stick with that, but it must be said, Occupied is more to do with how you deal with the how your democracy work and what you're able to or what you're willing to sacrifice if some of these rights were taken from you, and how you react, you know. So it had definitely a very different perspective upon Norway as an oil nation.
There's so many different paths you can take to react, and you put so many of your different characters down those paths. I don't know, as we're recording this, we're in the middle of season two on Via Play, so I don't know what kind of rules we want to have regarding spoilers. Season one feels like it's been out there. We can talk openly about, maybe a little carefully around season two.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask, though, before we get into the details of the show, you talked earlier about your experience on Prozac Nation and sort of not having control end-to-end post-production, a lot of people having ideas who maybe don't even understand what the content is all about. What's it like to be the showrunner on a TV show? Do you own everything that happens? You said that you were part of it from concept to post-production. Is it you who actually has control, or is it a collaborative effort, or how does that work on set?
It's a collaborative effort. The producers are definitely involved as well. There's Gudny Humlevold on the Norwegian side and Marianne Gray, Swedish side. I'm co-creator with Karianne Lund, who's the main writer. I work together with her and several other writers, you know. And then you have on Occupied, we have several different directors. I've directed five episodes in season one and two, but we have other directors who get involved. It's a different experience for me being a creator than being a director on my features, because it's such a big group of creative talent, which in a way I'm the leader of. Being a creator, I know how other creators and directors, you know, writers feel, and maybe it's different from person to person, but you know, it's the sense that you need to feel a freedom, but at the same time, a project like Occupied, it also needs to have some guidelines and a framework, you know, to create a singular universe.
I was going to ask, how do you maintain you have simple things like color palettes that have to be adhered to, but somehow you have to maintain this red thread, and it must be a little bit of a challenge to hand it off from director to director and say, come back with your vision, but make it look like everything else.
Yes, it is. It's not like in the States. When I hear colleagues in the States, I get a sense that they have a more sort of sorted process. You know, we don't have that rich sort of tradition of doing this. So we have to somehow find our way in dealing with it. I think directors coming in, most of the directors we used on Occupied have been feature directors. So it's been a relatively new experience to quite a few of these directors. They have to get used to a feeling of being censored at certain points, you know, or being undercut, you know, and you have, you will have, as a director, you need, I think most good directors are somewhat extremely devoted to their projects, you know. I think that's part of that almost kind of possessive madness you have, you know, to go through with it and sort of force your will through it all and remain creative. But within a TV show like Occupied, that has to be, in some ways it's part of my job to maintain their original sort of temperament, you know, in their approach.
And at the reason you brought them to the project in the first place.
Exactly. And then at the same time, guide them. And sometimes I have to come in to sort of course it's what producers do as well. But I'll have to come in and sort of say, I think that's a great idea, but it doesn't fit into Occupied. Whereas other times, and part of the privilege of doing this with other directors and colleagues is that they will come with ideas which I wouldn't have come up with, and they will expand the universe in ways which is actually healthy for the project. But finding that balance is, of course, very difficult.
Yeah, keeping control but allowing some other influences in. Tough balance in lots of different industries. Mm. So you made this as one of, at the time, biggest productions in Norwegian TV history. Where does that money go? Is it special effects? Is it all the military actions? I mean, where's the overhead in this?
A budget to me is almost like a headline in a paper. It there's never enough. It's basically any project I've done. You're always struggling to figure out, especially in Scandinavia, because, well, like Occupied, we are now on the international arena, you know, with Occupied, because it's basically being transmitted, you know, or seen in most parts of the world. So we're compared with much bigger budgets, but that's not what's on an audience's mind when they see it. So we have to be very creative in how we use money. The one of the biggest budget things is says more about, previously the national TV channel have not shown the real budgets, you know, when they've done dramas. But I would guess that their per minute drama, you know, budget would be just as high. It's not like,
so it was a shock headline and to a certain extent.
Yeah, and it's what you do, anything to get attention when you have a new series. You know, any headline will do. That's not to say it's still a big drama production in Norway for sure. Lots of people involved and all, but immediately when I was told about the idea and it was science fiction, one of the things I thought was, well, it's got to be the science fiction of what's just around the corner, you know, the science fiction of tomorrow, in a sense.
The choice of automobiles that you use, for example, that are just cutting edge-ish now. I see a lot of details like that.
Yeah, so it's because I thought if we're going to get into sort of creating a science fiction universe, let's say like Blade Runner, you know, we would run out of money to, you know, it just wouldn't be feasible, I think, within that budget.
In giving this project, I don't think that would resonate with people. I mean, it's sort of seeing civilians that might be like myself that engage me in this thing, and also politicians that might be representing me here, thinking, okay, what would they be doing in this situation? Would they be playing the same games or not?
Exactly. That was our interest, you know, to mirror our society and say, oh, what would you do? And how would politicians react, and how would judges react, and how did they react in the 1940s when it happened here in right. Norway and in most European countries? And that was the interesting aspects, and I think that's part of why it's been very successful, is especially going abroad for me. Like I recently went to Prague, and they were very I was interviewed by different TV channels, and you know they were very engaged by it, but of course, because Czech Republic had been occupied by Russia, you know, they had a different angle to what we would have here in Norway.
We have a sort of safe distance that's maybe giving us a false sense of security to it here still in Scandinavia. The reaction to season one, you say it's got a footprint that's gone around the world. You poked the sleeping bear, I guess, to use a bad pun. The Russian government actually reacted to season one, saying that they thought they were being unfairly portrayed as the bad guy. You always have to have a bad guy in this kind of a drama. Mm. It could have been anyone, but it is the Russians, and sort of life has imitated art. Art has imitated life over the course of Akhipirad. Mm. Has that influenced what you've done for season two? Or do you just continue with your plan for the story? Or do you take into account what's happening in the world?
I'm a news junkie, and I've become more of a news junkie working on Occupied, for sure. So but it's narrow-sided by any sort of Russian official who came out with the early criticism, is that it's I've explained this several times on different interviews, that you know we looked at lots of different international conflicts and how the powers that be would try and manipulate and sort of fabricate the truth or doctor it in different ways, you know, to suit their narrative. Our aim isn't particularly to criticize the Russian regime as of now. I can understand there's a reaction. I think most of the Well, we were criticized by lots of different groups. We were criticized by the Russian government, like you said, and Russian regime. We were criticized by Norwegians, who felt we were being impolite with our Russian neighbors. And we were criticized by a Russian minority in Norway who felt stigmatized.
Can I ask the Norwegians who thought you were being impolite, were they criticizing before they'd even seen the program or after it was released?
I would say most of the criticism we've received happened before the people criticizing it had seen the show.
I think those people that you described can actually see themselves portrayed somewhat in the story.
Yes, but in a paradox. I'm not complaining. I actually think it was great that we received all this criticism before the show was aired. It gave us the attention, you know, in this saturated media environment, you know. So it's not It's just a phenomenon. I've had it with some of my features as well, but maybe not to the same extent as Occupied. The Russian criticism, it sort of created a kind of an aggressive environment by some Russians. I and several were called lots of times by people portraying themselves as journalists, Russian journalists, and I'm not totally convinced they were all of them. Some of them were, for sure. And my main thing is we took a lot of care into sort of humanizing the Russian characters in our series. And we made effort not to create this kind of cliches of Russian characters, which are very common in popular culture, Western popular culture.
It seems to me it's very balanced. I mean, the parallel issues on both sides. The Norwegian government is trying to gain control while forces beyond their control are influencing things. And it's the same thing for the Russian ambassador. Mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't have a clear path. She's balancing influences from Moscow and everything else going on. So yeah, I mean, it's not good and bad, black and white by any means. They're all definitely human characters. Can I ask you, you say, well, you know, you examine how people might react in this situation. Your decision to make the prime minister character rather naive, at least in the onset. Mm. Was that very deliberate? Was that why that choice for the leader?
It came with the premise that, you know, someone that Norway, which was part of the main idea, you need an initiating action, you know, something which sets off the story. And in this story, Norway has stopped all oil and gas production for environmental reasons. We have selected a green government, and part of, I'd say, yes, it is naive, but it's also political fraction that says, if you really care about the singular most important issue of modern civilization, which is the environment, you have to do something radical, and then deal with the consequences of it, rather than the other way around, because you'd be bogged down into pragmatism. So that's how we sort of started it off. His, like any character in Occupied, I think it's almost, what does it take for you? What's the reason why you would eventually, if you are prepared to seek resistance? And our premise was more or less that, well, you'd feel like you had nothing to lose.
You have the head of the secret police's character expresses that perfectly, with nothing to lose, when she makes her decision.
Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like a premise, and the prime minister is a character who goes through a lot and tries to sort of, he's an idealist who tries to turn pragmatic, but eventually, we try to dramatize that he is not sure what he gains from it.
He's definitely going through some transitions now in season two. His character's definitely evolving.
Yes. Season two, we thought the characters are none of the characters are naive in the same way, which I guess naivety is part of, it's always been portrayed by other parts of the world as part of Scandinavian culture. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because it's also about the trust you have in the unwritten contract, you know, that everyone is on the same ship, joining the same project, which is our society, and we have to trust each other to sort of get the maximum effect out of that.
But again, life imitating art, life imitating art, art imitating life. We are just erasing those boundaries that we see in the U.S. where shame doesn't matter anymore. That was one of the unwritten boundaries that used to keep politicians in check to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, the parallels in the real world to the world that you guys have created.
Well,
in
yeah.
Occupierat.
I think that's what's kept me in it is this feeling that, well, Jon Espe's ID certainly had, I don't know what kind of looking a crystal ball he has at home, but even me, when I first read the ID, I wasn't attracted to it because it felt sort of like a social commentary with just waiting around the door, you know. I was attracted to the more idea of it, you know, like this is fiction, this what if fictional premise. And the more we started working with it, it is when actually there is, I just thought this is a very bold idea when I first got attracted to it. And I thought that's why we have to make it feel so authentic. Because we did lots of research with politicians, with army people, with sort of any kind of branch of society we entered, just to try and sort of get a sense of what would actually happen, and how can we dramatize it?
Just out of curiosity, when you approach the military, for example, with this what if scenario, how eager are they to talk to you about it? Is it something they're guarded about? Because it must be somewhere in their blueprints of possibilities. Or is it something they want to talk openly about and speculate with you?
They don't want to. The army is. They're a bit cautious when they approach us for several reasons. They don't want to be seen as sort of contributing officially to such a drama. But you can talk to retired people within the army, recently retired people. You know, there's always ways to sort of get a sense of what they think their common thinking would be, you know, or so information is available if you pursue it. Most information, that is. Of course, there are information that we never gain access to, and we don't know. We have to be sort of guessing. Stuff I've Googled, you know, I'm probably at the risk of my profile, you know, if they were to investigate me. It's probably close to sort of what terrorists would be Googling, because, you know, it's everything the curiosity we've sort of put into, so trying to figure out how does this work, it's been part of the thrill of working on Occupied.
Did you have any sort of influences out there that you looked at before you started on this? I mean, I see sort of, I don't want to, you know, be trite about it, but I see sort of elements of Tom Clancy type stories here. Are you looking at that kind of material before you get into Occupierat, or do you do blank slate and just go on your own?
When I get involved in the project, I don't look too much at specific other projects, because it's sort of, I don't know, it's just a sense that I'm being more creative by just trusting that whatever I like is going to seep into it some way or another. I was an admirer, like probably many people were, you know, of The Wire, the American series, which it's probably more than 10 years ago now. It's 15 years ago, purely because it sort of managed to portray how different parts of society influenced each other in what seemed like an engaging, to me it was an engaging way, you know. So that was definitely an influence.
Okay. So season one, well-received critically, politically, and commercially. Season two is out now. In the interim, you changed backers. We're seeing season two on Viaplay last year, I think, or last time around, I think Netflix had the rights to this. What happened there?
It's a market of who is willing to finance what we do in different regions. I still think Netflix will distribute it in several continents, like the States, and from what I'm being told. But here in Scandinavia, it's Viaplay who was willing to finance us. I think the first season was more of a, it was what had a what old school financing in a home territory, which was a TV channel. Now we're with a sort of streaming platform, you know, which is just a sign of the times, and that is exciting. I think it's
Was season two committed from the beginning, or did it unfold during season one or after season one? When was that decision taken?
Ultimately, it's taken when you know you have the finance. In my mind, it started to evolve in midway through first season. I felt like we were onto something, and I remember speaking to the producers and sort of saying, "Well, you know, there could be several seasons."
I was going to ask now, when you talk about story arc, then you don't see a conclusion at the end of season two. We'll have more room for the story to continue.
Yes, there's the possibility of another season, but to me, I think most likely that would be the final season then. Again, you know, you don't know for sure before you know you're going to be financed and everything.
That must be difficult from a storytelling perspective, to sort of what kind of an end you want to put on your season. Is it the finale of the entire project, or is it just the pause for the moment? That must be a real challenge.
It is a challenge, which is different to making movies. There's lots of things I like about TV shows and freedoms they give you creatively, you know. But how do you end the season, and when, and what's the sort of overall composition dramatically, you know, is of course more challenging because you don't know for sure. I guess it depends on who you're with and how things are planned, you know. But but yes, it has challenges, but I think it's not entirely new to me. If I work on a movie project, there's always this risk it might not be made, or we won't have the money to do it. You have to think very differently. So, and my best answer to that is to try and sort of gain control by sort of saying, well, okay, if we have the opportunity, we will make such many series or seasons or whatever, you know, and try and sort of think from that perspective. And then if it isn't to be, then it isn't to be.
So then as a creator, are you working on other projects at the same time? Do you have other things going on to fill the void if there is no season three?
Yes. Yeah, so currently as we speak, you know, this season two has just been released. I'm sort of working on several ideas, but it takes a while from an idea to see if it's actually going to work and all that. So yes, I am. But when we're shooting a season, it's so time consuming to be a creator of Occupied that I don't really get time to work on other stuff.
Yeah, the last thing you want to do is go home and start writing your next project, I guess.
Actually, when I go home, you know, you write on whatever's going to be shot in a couple of days, because there's always tweaks and there's always things which happen. You can't do this or whatever. So It's not like a traditional work. I think any creator of a TV show will say.
So season two is live right now on Viaplay. It starts out with a bang. I don't want to give too much more away than that. Your cast of characters return more or less intact and continue on with their challenges. Mm-hmm. If you haven't tuned in, you should catch up right away. If you haven't started watching season one, wow, I don't know what you've been waiting for, but that's there on Viaplay as well. It'll go to broadcast shortly in a few more months so that everyone can see it.
Yes, it's exclusive on Viaplay for I don't know how many months, but up until Christmas, I think. Then there's a co-producer in France, Arte, who's a broadcaster, and they will screen it early next year. And after that, it will go out to the rest of the world. I think most countries have bought it around the world. So it's definitely going to be seen out there in the world, which is a great feeling from our perspective. What's to say about season two? Occupied is also a thriller. It needs to have that kind of mix, in my mind, of real life politics, engaging characters, and a sense of you don't know what's going to happen next. So it needs to have a certain pace to it, and which we tried to maintain in the second season. It's quite similar to, in many ways, we just feel like we've gotten better at it in second season.
I think there's a lot of plausible surprises. People make moves, you think it's checkmate, and then you realize, oh no, there's another dimension here that unfolds. It's really, there's a great drama story going on.
Well, thank you. Yeah, this is what I try and make things which I like myself, you know, and I think the audience, especially the fans of Occupy, they are smart people. They've seen quite a lot. You know, they easily forget things, and I like this kind of state of sort of what's going to happen next, and you're not quite sure, but when it happens, it feels truthful to the character and to the situation. So we maintain that. We've also it's becoming more and more of an international conflict in this occupation in season two.
Yeah, and we're seeing scenes set outside of Norway more and more as well as a result.
Yeah, so we see how Europe gets involved, you know, and I guess we play around with when you dramatize, you have to simplify, but we play around with the situation in Europe at the moment. Mm-hmm. And there's always like a political, in some ways, you know, we comment on the political and political environment of the times, you know, and how they influence people. And
I think you do it really well and subtly. For example, in season one, the American ambassador, he doesn't have that much action, but somehow he portrays this American government that we can't trust right now without ever saying anything. It's interesting how you do that with so many different characters and so many different levels.
Well, what we do, like with him and others, we would think, well, we don't want to go to the old school traditional sort of national idea of who you are. That's what the science fiction element is interesting to us. You try and think, well, what would happen tomorrow? And we actually use our creative minds trying to sort of, what do we think and what would be funny about, well, funny and scary and all these things about tomorrow. In the first season, we sort of guessed, you know, America has become so protectionistic, they don't really care about NATO in the traditional sense anymore. And that was way before Trump, you know. Sometimes, you know, when you do these things, we don't do them because we think we're sure it's going to happen, but we just think, well, it could happen. and that's enough for us, in a sense.
We're running out of time here. I have one quick sort of footnote question. In season two, one of the innovations that you guys introduce is an app, a social app for protest. I won't really say too much more for people who haven't seen it. But where did you come up with the idea for that?
We were talking to especially the French producers. We're sort of quite open to hear people's ideas. And they said, well, in France, there's a lot of young people protesting against the meaning of democracy and what it is to us. And they said, aren't you interested in that? And he says, yeah, of course. But and then there's a mix of that and the feeling that, well, last year Pokemon was a hit, you know, my kids run around, everyone is sort of involved in this. I think the digital age is just changing everything about our society in ways which, well, later on it will be sort of named as one of the big sort of change of society. So and that's it was a mix of last year's protest in Paris and France and Pokemon, which got us started as to sort of thinking, well, how would the protest, what would be effective in this social media world which we live in, and how can you how can you voice your protest in a different way to just marching in the streets.
I'm waiting for someone to take that idea and run with it. I want to see that in the App Store. I thought that was very clever, among so many other clever ideas that are happening there.
Oh, thank you.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us. Once again, Occupied, available right now on Viaplay, season two, about halfway done, so dial it up if you haven't done so yet. I'm Brian. This is Stream Close Up, and we'll be back again soon.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for another edition of Stream Close Up. I'm Brian Laffin. Once again, this podcast was produced by the great Jose Fernandez Alameda, and we are brought to you by the good people at I Like Radio, who give us a lovely home. Please, if you made it this far, you must have found something that you like, so do us a favor. Give us a few stars on iTunes. Rate us wherever you find your podcast. We really appreciate it. And once again, if you want to reach out, you can always find us on Twitter @StreamCloseUp. We'll be back when we have something more to say.